All right, everybody, welcome to the 362nd edition of the Holy Backboard Podcast. I am Dustin here in Rip City, and I got my man.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Sage. We are part two-ing this, the technical difficulties in that first little part of the episode, but we are here. We are ready to talk about these Portland Trailblazers, and how are you doing this lovely Monday afternoon?
We got ourselves a Christmas tree on Saturday. We have all the house decorations up. I definitely feel like full dad mode. I got the ladder out, cleaning the gutters, put up some Christmas lights. Like, you know, just the things you see your dad do when you're growing up. Like, I was like, oh, this is my turn now. And then, you know, we made some gingerbread cookies last night with Olga, decorated them. It was a good time. Plus, we got stuff for my favorite holiday libations. If you're a fan of the White Russian cocktail, which, for those who don't know, it is vodka, it is Kahlua, and heavy cream. But during the holiday season, you swap out that heavy cream, and you say, give me some eggnog. So it's an eggnog White Russian, and it is absolutely fire. I always have to limit myself to one. They're so good. They go down so quick. But your boy's a bit of a lightweight. So leave it at one and then get to fight again the other day. You don't fight with the porcelain gods in the morning.
Dog, I actually remember I remember that White Russians are your drink of choice. But when you said heavy cream or eggnog, I was just like, ooh. My boy's got that English stomach. Cause if I tried that, man, my poor Asian belly would be really mad at me. One part of the alcohol and other because of that eggnog. Yikes. You go on, King. You go on, my white king. So
I mean, all things, like, this is my time of year. I am thriving. All things eggnog, like, I can make myself a very easy eggnog latte. You just put eggnog into the cup, make yourself a cup of coffee, pour the coffee on top of the eggnog, stir it. It tastes just like Starbucks, but for like 80% cheaper and super fast. So that's delicious. Salt and Straw has their seasonal eggnog ice cream, which is one of my favorites. Had some of that yesterday too. We gave Ari a bite of his first ice cream. Ari also had bites of his first pizza. So it was a big weekend at the Haas household.
Big dairy Ducks. Week for you too, my God.
Yeah, Ducks did not get it done, but
I was very, very, very sensitive to the fact that you guys lost and did not talk to you about that. I wasn't a very nice friend, not bringing it up to you or my older brother who are going through things with the Ducks.
Yep, but that's one of the benefits of being a father. It's like you don't have time to dwell on it. Like, it sucks. I'm devastated sports wise, but it's like, oh, well, it's time to get him down for a nap, change a diaper. Like, you got to wake up with him. Like, there's so many other things to do. And you also have another team, like I do, and you do as well, in the Portland Trailblazers. We're playing some pretty fun basketball right now. 6-13 on the season. But again, we're not talking wins and losses. That is the Holy Backboard mantra for the 2024 season. It's not about wins and losses. It's how the team looks in the competition. They split this week. They went 3-1 on that road trip, which was, 2-2 on the road trip. I keep forgetting they lost at Milwaukee because they were up by so many points. Either way, 2-2 on the road trip with really impressive wins over the Pacers and Cavs. The Cavs, they came back from 15 points in the second half, and they kind of ran away with it, 103-95. And then the final game of a road trip is always tough to close out. Playing in Utah is always difficult. Even with so many key Jazz players out, it was still a tough game for the Blazers. They ended up forcing overtime after trailing the entire game, but they lost it down the stretch, 118-113. A few bounces didn't go their way. Tumani Kamara's bank three was just after the buzzer. Shaedon Sharpe had an attempt on the basket that was deemed verticality. And there was an errant horn that went off in the middle of play. It was just kind of a cluster. But either way, they fought till the end, 6-13. Sage, tell me something that stood out to you this week.
DA's usage. And I get that Dwap Weef and Jabari have been playing well, but it seems like when DA is in, we don't feed him, we don't feature him at all. So the only way he has an effect on the game is defensively and rebounding wise. And that Utah game, if it wasn't for OT, he would have played like 28 minutes. And when we thought about bringing DA back to this team, it was to be a featured like 34 minute guy. If OT didn't happen, I think he would have missed out on like maybe like 28 minutes. So my biggest concern is DA. Like, Shane Sharp can be hit or miss with his shot. You know, Malcolm Brogdon's still overextended in his role. But the thing that made me feel weird is that DeAndre Ayton just didn't have like any real impact in any of these games, especially when like Utah had no real like people that could put pressure on him, and he could always guard Yurt 7, so why not use him? And I think one of the big things this year is DA great or elite? And we still really don't know this answer to it. And that was my biggest concern this week, was just the lack of DA in involved and in minutes played.
He did play 36 against Utah.
Yeah, but that was OT.
Okay, take out 31 minutes. I mean, he played 30 minutes against the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think a lot of it has to do, if we're just talking minutes with DeAndre, is Reith just gives the Blazers something that he is not able to provide. And that is floor spacing. And I just finished watching the Cavalier tape, and I can tell you that the minutes that Reith was on the floor was when Portland really made a run, because it opened everything up for everyone else on offense.
I just don't think Reith gives us, he's just a bad fit defensively for what we're trying to do, though.
They didn't seem to struggle against the Cavs when he was in there. But another thing that I noticed, and the Cavalier announcers picked up on as well, Ayton needs to start setting better screens, just flat out. He's kind of dying before the screen is set. And they were even mentioning that if the player just would have fought through, it was Darius Garland in this case, that they would have gotten whistled for, DA would have gotten whistled for an offensive foul for a moving screen. So, as a center, unless you're Jokic or Embiid in today's NBA, like, the two things that teams are asking you to do is stretch the floor and set screens, right? And DA,
we just had the week of DA hitting contested middies too, so he can do it. Like, you know, with the Suns, we didn't know he could do it, like stretch the floor, at least mid range extended.
Yeah,
we know that he can hit threes. He just doesn't get the opportunity anymore with us.
I mean, there are a lot of mouths to feed on this roster right now. You've got, obviously, Malcolm Brogdon. You've got Jeremy Grant. Scoot Henderson is back into the mix. There's 8 to 10 shots off the table. Teams are leaving Thibault open, making them pay. So there's 4 or 5 shots there. Tumani's being more aggressive. Obviously, you've got Shaden. Like, I think this next month and a half, 2 months, is going to get really sticky for the Portland Trailblazers, not in any negative way, but you are starting to see a fuller roster come back with everyone except Robert Williams III. And I think Reith has kind of taken what usage that Robert would have had, especially offensively, and even amplified that. I think he is getting more looks than we ever gave Rob. And then you're going to add in Anfernee Simons. So there's a whole other offense and defensive insertion that you have to figure out how to work around. And, you know, it is going to leave some people with a little bit lesser full of a plate. And in some cases,
I think DA might be option one for having a lesser plate.
Yeah. And I think for a player like Shaden, probably a good thing, right? Like, you don't need him 40 plus minutes a night. It doesn't matter that he's 20 years old, right? It doesn't matter that he hasn't played a lot of basketball. That's the key. He hasn't played a lot of basketball. His body is not conditioned. Really, no player is conditioned to play the amount of minutes that he was during the course of an 82-game season. Like, I think Billups completely overextended him. the Cavalier announcers also made note of that. And they said, like, he's really benefited from the time off in between games because it's really been a game, 2 days off, game, 2 days off.
He and Tyrese Maxey are just playing far too many minutes.
And you can see that when Shaden has time off, all of a sudden there's a little bit more bounce on that jump shot. All of a sudden he's finishing at the rim over Jared Allen and Evan Mobley. Like, all of a sudden things are starting to work. He's making the shots that he was normally missing. And I don't think it's any surprise that you're starting to get Brogdon, Henderson back, takes a lot more off of his plate. And now you put Simons back in. I think you're going to start to see things balance out a bit. And my question for you, Sage, is with Anfernee Simons returning, he could return as soon as Tuesday against the Golden State Warriors. The question that I had preseason, I have this on my Google Doc, and I wrote it down again without even referencing it because it's another thing that's on the top of my mind. Who is the man for this Trailblazers roster? Because if you go through recent history during rebuilds, when Brandon Roy and LaMarcus Aldridge were drafted, even with Zach Randolph on the team, it was evident from day one it was Brandon Roy. Not only did he have the leadership skills, the charisma, but he had the on-court production that everyone else could fall in behind. It was a little bit murkier with Damian Lillard, and I think it ultimately was the reason that LaMarcus Aldridge decided to leave is because there was kind of a divide between LaMarcus and Dame. Like, who was the man? Like, it was evident to everyone else besides LaMarcus that Dame was gunning for that number one spot, you know, made the All-Star team, Rookie of the Year. Like, it was evident. But that created a rift between LaMarcus and Dame. LaMarcus left, and now Portland kind of had to start from scratch. This year, it is so different because you have Jeremy Grant, who signs a massive contract. He's being introduced last by the PA announcer, which is traditionally left for, quote unquote, the man. But he doesn't perform well as the man. He's more of a complimentary piece. Then you have Anfernee Simons, who is being propped up by the franchise as well as one of the core guys, another young guard. Shaden has the potential to be that, especially on the production wise, but maybe personality-wise, he's more of just a lead by example. And then you've got Scoot, drafted as a generational talent, emotional leader of the team right now. Like, when he gets in there, like, he is really amping up the impact and really getting people going. But he is struggling to put that on-court production together like his predecessors in Roy and Lillard. And that's fine. He's 19. He's 3 or 4 years younger than they were when he was in the league. So all of this leads, and then you've got another veteran like Malcolm, who, you know, Simons was out, Scoot was struggling. He's like, it's Malcolm time now, right? Like, I'm a sixth man of the year. I'm a vet. I can take these shots. So you have like four or five players that it could be like, I think until they figure it out, I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think that's the next step in this franchise's trajectory into a rebuild is like, who's the guy? Like, OKC identified it right off the bat. It's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and they made moves to supplement that. Portland, I still think, is kind of teetering between a few players.
So I think the answer is, in the first three quarters, it's a mix of Brogdon, Jeremy, DA a little bit, and Shaden. And with Ant coming back, you put him into that mix. In the fourth quarter, it's basically Shaden is the alpha. Like, all fourth quarter is he has the ball in his hands. Malcolm Brogdon forces him to make those decisions. In the first three, Malcolm can go off. But what I've seen throughout this entire year is if Shaden is on the floor in the fourth quarter, he's making all of the decisions. So I think that Malcolm Brogdon and the brain trust is picking Shaden to be the main guy. It probably won't be Shaden in those first three quarters. And that's when I complain about Shaden gets all of this stuff in the fourth and then can't get warmed up in the first three. So I really think that they are trying to push Shaden into the decision-making role, especially when Scoot Henderson can't have a efficient and effective, repeatable long-range game. Shaden Sharpe is going to be our guy in the fourth quarter. But in the first three, it could be any. It's a mix of the the ball dominant people. But I think in the fourth quarter, when it slows down, Shaden's probably going to make the ultimate decision in these games. I mean, it's just been this entire year. If it's a close game, Shaden Sharpe is going to make the decision in one way or another. Like, and I think it's good. I just wish that he had that responsibility a little bit more in the first three quarters, so he isn't coming off cold and he's forced to be like, I'm the alpha in these last 5 minutes, but I haven't taken enough shots to really feel this. That's why I think when he gets the ball in the first three, he'll shoot it pretty consistently. Like, you know, the pass could be there, but he takes the shot. I think it's because he just knows that in the fourth quarter, he has to make the ultimate decision.
Yeah, I think you. And so what sparked this is I was watching second quarter. Shaden has the ball and he hesitates in his decision making. He's like, OK, I can probably score on this guy, but maybe Jeremy hasn't shot the ball in a while, or I see Jeremy on the wing and I need to pass to Jeremy. And he does. It's an errant pass and it gets stolen very easily. And it's clearly an error because he's processing it too slow. He's overthinking it. And that's the reason I kind of put a position to that question was, you know, I think he wants to be the guy. I think there, and you can tell, like, when Shaden is having a fabulous game, like he was brilliant this week. He was a nominee for Western Conference Player of the Week. 29 points on 11 of 15 shooting, 5 of 7 from 3, 10 rebounds, 5 assists, a steal in the victory against the Cavaliers. 25 points, 3 of 8 shooting from 3, perfect from the line, 5 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals in the game against the Utah Jazz. And when you notice those fourth quarter takeovers, or in the Cavalier game, it was kind of all game long.
Yeah, he was perfect in that Cavs game, essentially.
You really sense the confidence in him. And that's where we saw the final 10 games last year, when it was like, okay, you know, you are the guy, right? Like, this is your team. When he knows that, and he knows that he's not going to step on anybody's toes, or people aren't going to look over his shoulder. Like, when he is just laser focused, this is my team. Like, you just watch him move. Like, he's just so confident. He makes every step with a purpose. There's no overthinking it. He's just letting his natural ability take over. And I thought the Cavalier game was maybe the best he's ever played. It may have not have been the takeover that was the third quarter in Detroit earlier this season in November. But throughout the game, like, he only took 15 shots. It didn't feel like he even took that many. He really was intentional with every look. It was one of those games where you see a Kobe or a Jordan play. He was scoring from everywhere on the court, catch and shoot off the three, dribble step back threes, snaking through the defense, finishing at the rim, playmaking for others, which I thought he was just wonderful at, like snaking through the defense and kicking it out to shooters. Because when you have that gravity that we always talked about Damian having, when the teams have to focus on you, your teammates are going to be open. And he also, I think, and this may just be getting used to playing with new teammates. Again, we're not even 20 games in. His off-ball cutting was phenomenal against Cleveland. He knew exactly when and where to pick his spots. And credit Malcolm for
Malcolm needs
a, he's finally starting to get those extra dunks that we talked about a couple of episodes prior that just weren't happening. And I think that's making him maybe more of an active cutter, because like, oh, they're actually going to find me. It just seems like it's starting to mesh a little bit better with the other guards and Sharpe.
I think that Malcolm Brogdon deserves a lot of credit for Shaden's improvement, because it was like, yeah, Malcolm can easily, well, not easily, but Malcolm can take charge. And he does so in those first three quarters, but he really makes it an effort, like he puts in an effort to make sure Shaden Sharpe has the ball in that last fourth quarter. Like, DA even is like, okay, gets the rebound, looks for Shaden Sharpe. So that's why I think in the fourth quarter, Shaden will be the guy. And that, I mean, that's the most important time in a game. Like, it's not who starts it, who finishes that. And I think Shaden Sharpe is really the guy. But Malcolm Brogdon just making life easier for him, whether it be off-ball scoring or just making some decisions so he can just react, has been a really great thing for Shaden Sharpe and his development. Like, I know that we said that Malcolm Brogdon was too good to to mentor Scoot at this point in time, but he's doing a fantastic job of mentoring both Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe. So, like, I really think that that Malcolm Brogdon in these times has been worth his weight in gold. Like, he's able to take on this responsibility of orchestrating the offense and then having the wherewithal to be like, all right, this young bull, Shaedon Sharpe, is ready. I'm just going to feed him and space the court when Shaedon has the ball in his hands in that fourth quarter. I do wish that Shaedon had more responsibility throughout the game, but Malcolm Brogdon has been really great in that that sense.
Back to one of the guards, we talked about Shaedon, but let's talk about our other young backcourt mate and Scoot Henderson, who I thought looked really solid these past two games. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that the team is benefiting from his energy. His tenacity. Let's start, like, we always like to talk about is his offense, but let's start defensively, where I think the Blazers in general are doing such a wonderful job of talking on defense. They're actually communicating, and you can watch them when somebody has to pass a defender off, that they're clearly pointing and moving their mouths like we haven't seen before. Obviously, a benefit of that is having positional size across the board. But for having such a young, especially backcourt with Shaedon, Scoot, Tumani, like, none of those players have more than a year of service in the league. And they're just playing some really good defense. Scoot in particular is dogged out there. Like, he's hustling. He's really running to his rotations. I think he's harassing ball handlers. Like, yeah, he's going to pick up some fouls. He had five against Utah.
But I think the schematics just suck for what Scoot is as a defender. You said it. He's like a bull. He wants to guard the guard. The fact that it's like even the little bit amount of contact on the screen and it's an auto switch, I think makes him pick up fouls in bunches because he's 6'2", 6'3", guarding a 7-foot dude, and he's trying to front him or trying to get to a place where he can make a play. I think that our schematics really, really hurt Scoot's aggressiveness. Like, I would love for him to be in that guard's pocket the entire game, but the second they even set a screen that's a slip, it's an auto switch.
And then offensively, the shot came back down to life against Cleveland, 0-5 from three, off of a lot of really good looks. One was a heave, so you can really count that as 0-4 from three. But 7 assists in 21 minutes, and then he had a career high, 17 points, shot 2-5 from three, 5 rebounds, 3 assists against Utah, again, in 21 minutes. So he's being incredibly productive. And there's a play that I want to talk about, and I'd be interested if you're still able to remember. It's just really fresh in my mind. But this is kind of what I'm talking about as the Scoot Henderson effect and the effect of spacing. Like, we've been preaching, spacing is key. And it's important to note that leading up to this play in the early parts of the fourth quarter, Matisse Thybulle was lights out from three. I think he was like 3 of 4 from downtown, and the defenders really had to start respecting him. And so that's why this play is able to happen. You set the Scoot Henderson has the ball, trying to paint this picture, probably 3 feet extended from the top of the 3-point line. You have Reith to his left, Walker to his right, setting that double high screen. Well, what he does is he takes the ball with a hard dribble left. Jabari smartly slips, goes directly to rim runs. His defender is eyes on Scoot, eyes on the ball. And what makes this play work is Donovan Mitchell is guarding Matisse Thybulle. And it's his job to rotate down and take away Jabari Walker's run to the lane. But he couldn't do that because Matisse was hitting his threes. Mm-hmm. So Jabari has this runway to the middle of the paint. Scoot dots a laser right to him. And Jabari with the one-handed flush. Timeout, Cavs. Like, this is the type of offense that I want to see. I think this is the impact of having such a wonderful passer in Scoot Henderson, and the impact of having people who can spread the floor, because that doesn't work if Matisse isn't hitting his threes. Exactly. Because Donovan can just sag all the way off, right? So, like, this really gets me excited about a rebuild. And I see plays like this, and you're starting to see it all kind of come together for the Blazers. So I was really happy to see him have two strong performances. Like I said, it's no coincidence to me. This team is much more competitive when you can bring a guard of his caliber off of the bench.
Mm-hmm. Like, and I was starting to see like Ryan Russillo talk about how he's worried about about Scoot Henderson. And it's just like, dude,
has he played 10 games yet?
Yeah. I don't get like how you're like Wimby's special. Also, Wimby is like, doesn't get the ball as much as he should. Like, rookies are just trying to get adjusted. He was just playing, you know, G League Ignite 6 months ago, and he hasn't. I mean, he got hurt. There's so many reasons why he isn't, you know, the MVP Scoot Henderson that he could possibly be in the future. What I really appreciate is his willingness to shoot. I'm really thinking that he is most comfortable in top of the three. Like when he shoots at that top of the three, I feel like it's a pretty damn good chance of going in. But when you think about what he has done in his career, most of his operation is in the top part of the three. Like you don't really see him moving off ball, even with Dyson Daniels being a portion of that team a few years ago, he was still like doing most of his operation there. So he's really comfortable in operating at the top of the three. And when it goes in, it's like, oh, I believe in that. So I think that he has the ability to hit from three. It's just, he has to rep it out. So I really appreciate his willingness to not like hesitate. There's some guards and wings that hesitate and ruin their chances of an open shot. Scoot Henderson is not one of them. And I love the way that he can manipulate things with his eyes and, you know, set things up for others. But the fact that he is not afraid to shoot and probably miss from certain places makes me feel like he doesn't have that Ben Simmons in him where he just attacks and doesn't shoot.
Yeah, we're in early December. The team hasn't even played 20 full games. I guarantee you, health permitting, Scoot Henderson at the end of the season is going to be a completely different player than he is right now. You could already tell in the improvements that you see on a game-by-game basis, right? He's already a much better player than he was opening night. He's better player than he was right before he got injured, right? Like, he's going to... I think they're clearly bringing him along slowly. They're letting Malcolm take the bulk of the reins. But once it's, you know, late March, spring, or April, you're going to start to see Scoot get those starting minutes. And I think you're going to start to see him be a little more aggressive. He's going to get into his mid-range spots. I think he's going to start manipulating the defense. And he's going to be more comfortable, right? He's going to have almost a full season under his belt. But, you know, right now, it's still early in the season where every team is competing for victories, as teams do. But once the pack starts to separate itself from another, and I think maybe after the trade deadline too, mm-hmm. as early as you can see it, because I think Portland clearly wants to cash in on some of their assets and they want to be as risk averse as possible, especially after seeing what happened with Robert Williams III. Sage,
didn't he get 17 points in 22 minutes?
Yes.
That's pretty fucking awesome efficiency. But what were you about to ask me?
Say, I want to give Tumani some flowers because a couple episodes ago I said I need to see more. Like, yeah, you know, you take on a tough defensive assignment, but you can't just be out there getting cardio on offense. And I think defensively he's been phenomenal, right? Like I think he has been really, really solid. I just rewatched that Cavs game literally 15 minutes ago. So I was able to stop and start and look. He's guarding Mitchell. He's guarding Garland. He's made life very difficult for both of them. He had a great block on Colin Sexton to save that. Like, he just does little things that not everybody does. And you're wondering, why doesn't everybody do that? It looks easy enough. But off of a miss, Cleveland has the ball in transition. What does he do? He decides to stop and pick up Garland 94 feet. Garland dribbles the ball out of bounds because he's not expecting the pressure. I think he does a great job of having positional size with Shaden on the wings. Like, I think that's something we haven't had, I don't know, decades, right? Like, that makes life a lot easier when you can actually put out, you know, 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", guys on the wing. And he's doing it as a second year or as a second round pick, a late one at that. But offensively, like, he's kind of like Scoot. he may not make the shot, but I'm happy that he's taking some of the shots, because you have to keep a defense honest, as we just touched on with Matisse Thybulle. Mm-hmm. And then you're also starting to see him put the ball on the floor a little bit. Like, he had a great dunk on Walker Kessler, but he also had a really good play in the clutch against the Cavs. Like, got the ball in the short corner. Max Strus closes out, gives him baseline because he's not believing that he's going to take him baseline. Timani takes him baseline and just dunks on the Cavs. And I think obviously scouting reports are going to catch up as they do. But just to see the growth in 2 weeks, even as minimal as that, like, I'm much more excited about the long-term prospects than I was of just being like, oh, Tumani's out there grabbing offensive rebounds. Like, he's doing more than what I saw 2 weeks ago. And that's all I was asking for. And he's like, that block on Sexton was just ridiculous for any level of experience in the league. Like, wonderful chef's kiss for those watching on YouTube.
I mean, I guess we're watching two different things. I really don't think, like, I think that the Blazers are putting him in positions where he won't succeed. So, I mean, like, him going 94 feet worked once. Good for him. I really don't think that he, I don't, I think the Blazers are putting him in a bad position, and he's accepting the responsibility. I don't think that he should be guarding the best player on the court. I think he probably would be more valuable playing off-ball defense, because putting him in a place where he has to use his lateral quickness isn't going to be a good thing for him, because I don't think he has it. But I think if you put him in a place where he can use his athletic gifts going vertical, I think that he can. When I watch him or Shaedon Sharpe, it's just so much difference because of the lateral ability Shaedon has. So I appreciate what he's doing in the help and being somebody that does, you know, like, he takes the open shot, but he's just a high effort role player to me that is overextended.
That's all you need. That's great to be excited about. We've been yearning for these awesome role players. I don't think Shaden's ready physically, endurance wise, to take on the task of being a go-to scorer and guarding the team's best player. So I think that's why you're also seeing Tumani get bigger and more difficult defensive assignments, because Shaden's just, he's not, like, you, not many people are, really. I can only list the few wings off the top of my, like, there's less than five that I can think of in history that have been able to take a multiple, like, approach, like, okay, you got to be the man on offense. Oh, and you also got to lock up on defense. Like, that's rarer than rare. So hopefully he gets there, but I don't think he's even close right now. I think the Blazers, they've been, obviously they have lapses. There's no reason they should have lost to Utah, but some could say there's no reason they should have beaten Indiana or Cleveland, a team that just dusted them at their own gym by 20 points, like, less than 2 weeks ago. So you're going to see a lot of variance in this roster. They're going to win some. They're not supposed to. They're going to lose some. They're not supposed to. But one of my new found accounts, Nikias Duncan on Twitter, says the Blazers have the eighth best half court defense in the league. And I want to get your thoughts, Sage. How is the insertion of Anfernee Simons back into the fold, how is that going to impact Portland's defense? Because nothing against Anfernee, I think it's negatively going to impact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because what obviously he's going into the starting lineup, but we just praised the Blazers for having positional size with Brogdon, Sharpe, Kamara, Grant, and Ayton. Who are you removing from that starting lineup? Like, if you remove Malcolm, I guess you have, Malcolm is much more bulky than Anfernee. I think he's a better, even as he has an old man game, even as old man game as he has, he's a better defender than Ant. Or if you remove Kamara, yeah, you get better offensively, but now you're making Shaden guard threes and you have Ant and Brogdon in the backcourt defensively. Like, that doesn't seem like a great option either. So it seems like Portland's calling card when they've won games is, you know, a lot of scrappy defense, playing the passing lanes, kind of mucking it up a bit. That could be going by the wayside, and they might have to find other ways to win. out shooting folks. So I think it's just going to be interesting. But what? How do you think that transition is going to work?
I have no problem with Shaden defending threes. So, but I think they probably take out Malcolm because he was prepared for being a six man. And then him and Sharp can go in, and him and Skill can go in and run offense together. I don't think that they want to mess up potential, you know, active size for Ant. And I don't think Ant comes in game one and plays 34 minutes. I think they have.
Do you know who our coach is, Sage?
I get that, but at the same time, he doesn't do it with Scoot right now. Scoot's kind of locked into 22 minutes a game.
I don't think he trusts Scoot like he trusts Ant, like he trusts Malcolm, like he trusts Jeremy. Like, this is his guy. Like, he's, you know, he's going to ride him till the wheels fall off.
Yeah, but I don't think initially it's going to happen. I think that you have, I think that they're going to at least slow it down like the first few games. But I imagine that Sharp and Ant play together, and then they run the wings of Tumani and Matisse. But I mean, I could be wrong, but Malcolm was prepared to be the sixth man. He took advantage of the opportunity presented to him with the injuries. But I think that he knows that as long as he's on this team, he's probably going to be the sixth or seventh man. I mean, here's the thing about Malcolm Brogdon. There was the issue with his health. That's why he didn't, you know, like he didn't pass a physical. I think he's proven to every team now he's healthy and can play like 30 plus minutes. So if like Miami wanted to trade for him, we don't need to play him 30 minutes now. He's proven that he's healthy. Now we can potentially scale him back. And Miami still knows what they're getting with Malcolm. So
all the nice things you've said about Malcolm on this podcast, are you still moving him for a first round?
Yes. Play? Yes.
I agree. Yes. Yeah, I think you have to. I think the backcourt's starting to get more too crowded. In the benefits of Brogdon, like if you didn't have Anthony Simons,
sure,
I could see a world in where you keep Malcolm Brogdon, right?
But Ant's probably going to play 30 minutes a game, right? Like there's not much you can do with Malcolm Brogdon, Scoot needing minutes.
There's clearly a commitment to Scoot and Shaden, and I think that's
pretty evident. Yeah, it's like. And now that like Tumani's has a role, like Malcolm Brogdon knows he's a professional. I think that he has wonderful tape right now for whatever team needs a guard that can hit threes and be a secondary ball handler. I think he has wonderful tape. He might need to scale it back since we have financial and, you know, draft commitments to these guys. I think he's going to take a little bit of a step back. I mean, he still is going to be a professional and help Scoot, Shaden, and probably Ant with their development. But I think that he's probably going to be the one that has to take a little bit of a backseat for everybody else.
All right, I'm going to list three players because December 15th is slowly creeping up, and that is the date when free agents can be moved. And I think we're getting pretty close to it being 90 days since also Malcolm has been acquired as well. So Sage, on the Sage-o-meter, 1 to 10, with 10 being hot, 1 being ice cold, chances of Malcolm Brogdon getting moved anytime before the deadline, what number is that for you?
Before and at the deadline?
He has to be traded before the deadline.
Yeah.
Just in this season, before the deadline.
Oh, I think he's getting traded.
Does he get moved?
I think he's getting traded.
What number?
9.8 out of 10.
Jeez. Okay. Matisse Thybulle, who is dang near 40% three-point shooter, a really solid off-ball defender. I think a lot of contending teams could use him off of their bench. With you mentioned it, Tumani's development and newfound role in the starting lineup. Matisse is also on a pretty friendly contract. Mm-hmm. What are the chances do you think the team moves Matisse before the deadline?
7.8. You got right. Chris Murray and Ryan Rupert behind him. He is just stopping all of their development in the NBA. Like I know what Matisse is going to provide me. I have no idea what Chris Murray and I have no idea what Ryan Rupert can do with those. Do you think Matisse gets a guaranteed 20 minutes a game? I think that can go, that would be more valuable for Chris Murray and Ryan Rupert. So I think it's rather high that he gets traded to a good team.
I would agree with that, especially with two first round picks in the fold for this offseason as well. And it's littered with forwards.
We need to know what Ryan and Chris can do.
Lastly, at this level, Jeremy Grant signed a 5-year mega extension, eligible to be traded on December 15th. You talk about teams having tape. I don't think Jeremy's tape has looked much better than it has these past couple of weeks. Just killed it in Indiana, had a great game, put up over 30 points, was just absolutely clutch to start the season. He continued to increase his point production game by game by game. A lot of teams could use a Jeremy Grant as a third or fourth option, but Portland does need the salary to stay near the floor. And I do think they like having his veteran presence. I don't think they want to bottom out like teams
like the Wizards.
Like the Pistons, like the Wizards are really the Pistons aren't doing it. The Pistons are just bad, but the Wizards are definitely trying to bottom out. What's your temperature gauge, say, on Jeremy Grant?
I think it's a 2.5 out of 10.
Yeah, I was going to say it's right in the middle. It's a 5 for me.
Oh,
I think
wow.
If they knock
our socks off, we do it. But if it's exactly, just a random
somebody's
one,
going to offer you two first round picks and some good salary relief, I think they would be foolish not to do it. Also, I don't know if the discussions with Jeremy's agent and the team were. Clearly, he was cool coming back for the largest contract he could get and to play with Damian Lillard. But if the team is, again, not even sniffing the playoffs, would he was that the plan all along that he would welcome a trade? I don't know, but I don't think they'll move him just to move him. Right.
Yeah. It has to be a good trade, but I don't think that it's coming this year for Jeremy Grant. I think that the right trade might come next year. I just don't think that this year we're getting Tari Eason and two Houston first round picks for him, which would be fucking dope.
Yeah, come on, Santa. Let's deliver me Tari Eason and some first-round picks.
Is he the number one power forward you want? Or is it
I would
Jarrett?
Put Tari at the 3. I know positions don't really matter, but yeah. I like the 3 more than the 4, just because I like size across the board. But no, I really like Tari. I was really glad Jeremy played great against the Pacers, because it's like, you guys could be starting Jeremy Grant instead of Obi Toppin. Just
did you see how bad Obi Toppin is?
He's not great.
Did you? Oh, so I was looking at I think it was Dunks and Threes. His rim defense is the same as Buddy Hield's rim defense for the Pacers.
Yeah.
I mean, Jairus Walker's just chilling on the fucking bench. And
that's what I'm saying. If Joe Cronin is at least making phone calls and seeing some of these teams that are maybe doing better than they expected, hey, Houston, I know you're trying to be competitive. You don't want to give OKC that pick. Hey, Indiana, you got a future superstar right now in Tyrese Halliburton. You want to surround him, right? I mean, Jeremy Grant would bump up those assist totals much more than one Obi Toppin. But I think that
Miles Turner and him rebounding the ball would drive Carlisle absolutely fucking bonkers, though.
Not my problem. Let's look ahead to this week's slate of games. I am actually back on top of our prediction standings. I think predicting every Utah game correctly so far has done me well.
Yeah, it's a clutch.
I am +1 in the department, but shame for me, we only have one more game against the Jazz left to take advantage of. But just two games on the week, as Portland found out their opponents due to the in-season tournament.
How do you feel about the in-season tournament before we go into the...
I don't want to sound too much like old man yelling at the cloud. It's regular season basketball, and that's all it's really meant to be.
Really? Because I would... Yeah. I think that you're wrong. I think that...
I'm not wrong. It's my opinion.
Well, your opinion's wrong, because I watched the Cleveland Cavaliers Bulls game, and they were hacking Andre Drummond in the fourth quarter.
I understand
for point differential
but still, like, all it is it's a competitive regular season game, right? That's if you tell teams, would you rather win the in-season tournament or get better playoff positioning? They'll say playoff positioning is more important, but the in-season tournament's accomplishing both. It's in this weird catch-22 because it has to be tied to the regular season for it to matter, but it will never matter more than the regular season because June is what everyone is playing for. So I think it's
I see players playing different rotations. I see good players playing longer different rotations.
This should always happen, though.
It's better basketball than you see in the regular season, period, because you don't see like superstar players like leaving the game when they're up 8 or 10. Like, they're playing full rotations. So in theory, it has to be better basketball since better players are playing.
And the NBA also instituted their participation policy. So I was already anticipating the good players not resting as much. So
but to me, it's resting mid-game, like they're playing an extra rotation. So they if you want to talk about the bad looking courts and uniform, sure. But I think because that
doesn't bother me. Like, I guess I just don't care. Like,
that's totally fine. But these dudes are playing more. So in theory, it's a better game because you're seeing Donovan Mitchell play instead of Dean Wade. I was about to call him Dean. That's how little he produces in games. Like, yeah, so it's better players playing.
It's not for me. I don't even know what teams are in the in-season tournament. Like, I think I know a few.
Kings,
like,
Pelicans tonight, and Utah. Oh, no, not Indiana.
They need to do a better job with the groups, because I couldn't have told you. I don't know who the hell was in the Blazers group. And I was under the assumption that every team was going to be playing on Tuesday and every team was going to be playing on Friday for the in-season tournament. And it was just like, are we tonight? Like, it wasn't very, I don't know. And again, like, if you're going to raise a banner for the in-season tournament, I'm going to ridicule you and laugh at you. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not what you throw a parade for. If it gets young guys extra money, good for them. But like, for me, I'm not going to rock an in-season tournament championship tee. Like, I do it ironically for the summer league, but that's because it's clearly satire. Like, if it gets players to play a little bit harder, cool, I guess we'll see. But like, in terms of, maybe it's because the Blazers are just terrible this year. I just didn't care. Right. Maybe if we were close to doing it, I probably would have cared more. But like, when you're a fan of a rebuilding team, like, I just want to see us play good basketball. Like, we played that mini series against Memphis. I didn't care if we won the in-season game or we lost the other game. Like, I just wanted to see good basketball.
I'm sure that the fact that we're not at the point where we even need to think about competing changes your opinion, but I've actually enjoyed watching these games because they're playing harder and longer minutes.
And if it gets them to do that, you know, that's obviously the goal. And as long as it doesn't take more precedence over the regular season. So again, why it's tied to the regular season is important, because it shouldn't be more valuable than the ultimate prize, which is the playoffs and the championship trophy. All right. So two games from the in-season tournament, one at Golden State. So a game Blazer fans really should root for a victory, Wednesday, December 6th, and then Friday, December 8th against the Dallas Mavericks. So just another quick two game week. Sage, the Blazers are 6-13, but they're 4-8 on the road. They played a road heavy schedule, 12 road games compared to 7 home games. So they're going to play another one on the road, and they're going to play a team in the Golden State Warriors that are kind of going through it right now. They're 9-11. They're just 4-6 at home. They're 3-7 in their last 10. And I try to watch them as much as I can, because clearly Portland has skin in the game. Portland gets their top 4 protected pick. And I was watching that game, like, against the Kings on TNT, another in-season tournament game. But I was watching because, like, lose, Warriors, lose. And it looked like they had that thing in the bag. And then they made the most un-Warriors-like plays over the final stretch of 60 seconds that I've ever seen under Stephen Curry and Steve Kerr. Up by 6 with the ball, and they managed to throw that thing away. And you've got Draymond getting ejected during the season, you know, 5-game suspension. Klay just looks broke. Wiggins can't rebound. Who knows how much more juice. I mean, we're in early December, and Steph is being asked to do a lot. They're not playing Jonathan Kuminga. Moses Moody is actually playing better than Klay Thompson right now.
Yeah, pretty good.
And their rookie from Santa Clara, Brandon Podziemski, is giving them a little bit of oomph off the bench as well. But Right now they're out of the play-in. They are going to win more games, but like, if you would say over under 41 wins, I don't know what number to take, just because like they're all of those extra title runs have just sucked so much energy and life out of their basketball bodies that, I mean, I just don't know what they're going to do. I was listening to a podcast the other day. I think it was Zach Lowe, but he was talking about how Bob Myers, when he was the Warriors GM, obviously it's Mike Dunleavy Jr. now, they never made in-season trades. All of their decisions were done after the season. Like the GP2 trade with Portland last year was the first one they had made in like something like a decade. It's just something incredible like that. Chris Paul's been banged up, which, surprise, surprise, not to be expected for somebody who's been playing basketball in the NBA since 2005. Shout out high school class of 2003.
Your high school class was 2003?
Yeah. You're 08. You're still old as shit too, bud.
I know. But yeah, I was 09.
No, you were 08.
No, I graduated 09, bro.
You're still old as shit to me.
I absolutely know. But
so long-winded way of saying these are not your father's Golden State Warriors. The faces might be the same, but the games sure are not. It's going to be tough. Obviously, Portland, I can't remember the last time Portland's won in the Bay Area. But what are you looking for in a matchup with the Warriors where it just seems like every game, I think they're missing that continuity because it seems like they're missing somebody every other contest.
Unless it's changed, it's Steph Curry and Brandon who have scored over 20 points. So it's kind of obvious who you needed to send most of your focus on is Stephen Curry. If we can make him work and if he has an off game, I think there's a very good chance that we can win because I don't think the Warriors' secondary and tertiary players are going to win them a game. So as long as we can attack, if we can defend Steph Curry and actually score offensively, I think we have a chance. But obviously
Wiggins and Chris Paul are both day-to-day. Gary Payton II is out for an indefinite amount of time with his calf injury. This game is winnable. This game is definitely winnable, especially if you're looking at a Blazers team that's getting, I think, 3 days off of rest.
That Ant plays?
Yeah, judging by the tweets I've seen this morning, it seems like he's going to be good to go. And I think that works against Portland.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking too.
That's another player you have to find. Like, I feel like they were just... Yeah, you're having to find his role now, too. Like, I think they were just starting to get some rhythm and chemistry with Malcolm and Scoot, some, like, stability. And it's just, like, another piece to the puzzle that you have to find, and you're like, I don't know where it's at. It could be in any room in the house.
Last week we were taught... at least I was complaining that Shaden looked lost because he didn't have his role because Malcolm Brogdon was back. Could you imagine the players below Ant that have to adjust to that type of player coming back in terms of roles and usage and all of that stuff? I mean, it's going to mess the order of everything up because people are either moving up or moving down a role. So if he comes back, I think it's unless he has one of his Ant, I'm going to shoot 10 threes and make 8 type of games, I think it's a bad one for us.
I'm playing with house money here. I'm up in the predictions game. Also, we need this victory. This is going to be the best game to win. Blazers.
There's
win.
A lot of basketball left, so
no, better this keep is, getting this wins. This is the game that matters for the Blazers right now. You got to beat the Warriors. You got to enhance their pick. Blazers are going to win. They do well when they get lots of time off. And Golden State's reeling right now. They're not going to take us seriously. I think this is the game for the Blazers.
Do we like box in one Steph, or what do we do to stop Steph?
I think you have to, every time they try to set a pick and roll, is trap him, trap the ball handler and make them make swing decisions and just trust that guys like Clay, guys like Moody aren't
Wiggins.
And if Wiggins is day to day. So like, I don't know. Jeremy Grant is in concussion protocol, but like we're not playing until Wednesday. So I'm assuming he's still going to come back because Blazers again, haven't played since Saturday night. That would seem like it would be.
Did you see his injury? It didn't look good. It didn't look good. So I think it's a 50-50 bargain that he plays or not.
I'll pull a Sage. If Jeremy plays, Blazers win. If Jeremy doesn't, Blazers lose. That's, I forgot about that when I was really hyping myself up for that game. But yeah,
Jeremy. I think we would have beat Utah pretty easily if Jeremy was there, because you replace him with Matisse, and offensively it becomes a lot easier. Like, they hit, like, they put the two non-shooters in the corner next to, and DA there, and then it was a really easy help assignment. I think the Warriors win, because I don't think we're prepared to stop Steph Curry. Like, he might be old, but he's fucking awesome.
The last game of the week is against the Dallas Mavericks. It is a home game, and the Mavericks injury report is long, but it's almost all day today, with the exception of Maxi Kleber, who is out for at least 2 weeks. But again, that was back on November 11th. But everything else is day to day. Kyrie's day to day. Tim Hardaway Jr., Josh Green, Dante Exum, Luka Doncic is still there. He's returned after the birth of his first child, so congratulations to him. The big difference with the Dallas Mavericks this year, I think, has been the addition of Grant Williams. Mm-hmm. And then they finally have a lob threat from Luka. Derek Lively.
And Derek Jones Jr.
That's the matchup that I want to see, is DA against Lively. Mm-hmm. Like, they do kind of similar things. Which team is going to incorporate their big better? I think this is a good game to try to get Lively into foul trouble and make Dallas go small. Because yes, Luka can score on his own, but he's most lethal when he's operating that pick and roll. And you know he's an equal threat to score, but also to throw it up and get 2 points for his big man. So that's the matchup. DA and Lively, that's what I want to see.
I think that it's... I think that this is actually a positive matchup for Tumani to defend, because Luka's not going to hit him east-west. He's going north-south, so he's able to use his athleticism. So I think Tumani's going to have a really good defensive game against Luka. Like, he's not going to average 1.8 points per minute. So I think that Tumani and Matisse actually can play defense in this one. So it's about us staying disciplined on everybody else and letting Matisse and Tumani do their thing against Luka. But I think that the Mavs just
have... Like, you're worried about Steph. I'm much more worried about Luka.
I'm still mad at Kyrie for doing so shitty when Luka's out. I think Dallas wins, but I think that we're going to do a remarkably good job against Luka compared to, like, the mean of Luka performances. I think this one will look a little bit worse. So, but I think that the Mavericks win. Just, they have so many offensive talented players. Like, Tim Hardaway, I've seen him hit some really mega difficult shots this year. Like, they have guys that can just score in bunches. Like, Seth Curry can't defend at all, but you know what he can do on the offensive side of the ball. They have a lot of shooters, but I think that initial first push, we're going to do an all right job at it, but Dallas wins.
All right, I think that wraps up
this episode.
What, you already predict Dallas to win.
Oh, okay.
Sage, take us on home.
All right, that should wrap it up for this episode of the Holy Backboard. We have been discussing what we're going to do with the future Fridays content. We're going to start with my number one guy, Alex Saar, and then we'll go on talking about draft stuff. I mean, it's getting close to time where we need to start talking about these guys, that we do have two first round picks. So be prepared for that. And we will be back next week. We are available on iTunes, every pod feeder that you go to. We are there. We're on YouTube as well for the full version of this podcast, if you want to see us look at each other with loving eyes. And we are available on Reels, on IG and Facebook. And then if you want to look at us at TikTok, we're there. It's DeSageHB. So check us out. We're everywhere. Peace.